Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
I'm Kenny Holmes.
I am Robert Kraft.
This is Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're off and running after a big season premiere, and here we go, episode two, saying hello, as always, to composer Carol. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
You guys ready? Are you caffeinated? We have another big one here.
I would say if you look up over-caffeinated in the dictionary, they have a full-page picture of me. How about you? You're the coffee man.
I actually haven't had my coffee today yet, so that's you guys incredible. Might have to carry
I'm
this
I'm having
one.
Mine.
I think that's a headline right there.
It really is. Okay, I have a trivia question for
Shoot.
You. Who, please name the most Oscar-winning musical person living right now.
Oh, living, because I was going to say I know non-living. Oscar nominated or winning?
Oscar winning. Who has the most Oscars of a living musical person today?
Well, there, first of all, there's going to be, of course, I was going to say Maestro John Williams, but when you say musical person, it makes me think.
It's not John Williams.
Is it composer Carol?
Is it me?
It is not you.
Or is it our guest today?
The answer perhaps? Is our guest today, Mr. Alan Menken, eight-time Oscar-winning composer and songwriter. I thought it would have been John Williams, but when I looked it up, the only person that has more Oscars than Alan Menken in the musical sense is Alfred Newman.
Correct. David Newman's father and Thomas
Newman's
father.
That's correct. So on today's show is an icon. He's a composer. He's a songwriter for so many of the greatest animated films, first off. I mean, he's the Disney savior in terms of animation with music. Films like Little Mermaid, Aladdin, Pocahontas, Hercules, Beauty and the Beast, and then all the non-Disney stuff as well. One of your favorites, Robert, Newsies.
Oh, love Newsies.
So anyway, Alan is, you know who Alan is at this point if you're listening to the show, I think. But we are so excited to have him on because we've been trying to get him on for a couple of seasons and some scheduling things didn't work out. But he's got the new Little Mermaid live action coming up. So we're going to be able to talk to him about that, working with Lin-Manuel Miranda. And then also he recently had the live action Aladdin come out with Will Smith and doing that whole thing. So it's kind of interesting, Robert, right? I mean, he went through this wave of these massive hit films and now they're kind of redoing them all, not in the same order, but this is an interesting experiment. Where do you stand on all of this stuff with the remakes and the live action?
I think that first of all, there's obviously a commercial angle. Disney just knows how to extend the brand of all these different movies and not only sequels, but live action and all that. I also think it's sort of a wonderful opportunity for Alan to revisit his work, I'm guessing, and we can find out when we talk to him. And also maybe in each one of them, there's going to be a new song or two. So he has to come back to some narrative issues that maybe weren't addressed. That sounds really official. Listen, God bless them all. I think the world probably needs a few more Little Mermaids and Beauty and the Beast and things that make people so happy. You can tell. We asked if people had favorite Alan Menken movies and scores. In the score
it's all over
mailbox.
The place.
And it was just so many of them came back. You thought, this guy's really entertain the world. So
yeah,
makes me happy.
Well, and plus you worked with him on Little Mermaid.
I sure did.
All those years ago. And what I think it's been 30 years since that film.
I'm 31 years old, I did start. I was in diapers when I went down to Record Plant on Sycamore to do that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been 30 plus years. And I had no idea what I was getting into. I got a call from Chris Montan, the head of music at Disney, asking if I'd be interested in producing. These two guys, Alan Menken and Howard Ashman, with this musical they had at Disney. And it was sort of, I guess, yeah, it's work.
Boy, and we've talked about how this was a time when it was a rebirth of Disney, right? Because before Little Mermaid, it wasn't this big, huge, anticipated, what's the next Disney musical movie that's coming out? And when these guys showed up on the scene, everything changed moving forward.
Absolutely revolutionized what and who Disney was. It was 86, I believe. And it was the first of a new era that now is, you know, ginormous Disney.
But it was a whole new world?
Yep, it's a whole new world. I would say it is a whole new world that is somewhere under the sea with a hunchback.
So anyway, Alan Menken joining the show in just a bit, and we're really excited about him. By the way, Robert, I'm wearing the t-shirt you gave me for my birthday. And so if there's any problems today, just read this manual on my shirt.
Happy belated birthday, Kenny.
In post. Thank you.
Yes.
We'll fix it in post. I told Robert I would wear it on this week's episode.
I am so happy. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Before we get to the show here, we want to take a second to thank our sponsor, Spitfire Audio, maker of orchestral sample libraries for film composers. Whether you're just starting out or a seasoned professional, Spitfire has so many sounds you will love.
Did you know that they release a new library in their free lab series every month? And I download them. I mean, it's a great freebie, and they're always really cool. You can get an entire orchestra for free in the form of their BBC Symphony Orchestra Discover Edition.
Yeah, and those are on top of the free stuff. They have a ton of different packages. And we have a promo code that we're going to share with you. At the end of this episode, you're going to hear a demo from their latest Abbey Road 1 release. It's called Wondrous Flutes. And this package features fast flowing and fun. That's really fun to say. Thanks for that script, Ben. Fast flowing and fun. Fast flowing and fun. And piccolo performances. Flute and piccolo performances with dazzling legato patches. Wondrous Flutes has been captured within the cinematic acoustics of Abbey Road Studios Studio One by London's first call session players. So all the best players playing these sounds, and these pre-orchestrated patches give you instant access to an immediately recognizable sound as heard in some of the great scores recorded there in Abbey Road One Studio One, like John Williams scores, John Powell, a lot of those Star Wars sounds that you're familiar with. Those are the types of sounds you're going to hear in these packages.
I can't deny that whenever I think about Studio One, I get slightly happy because Studio One is just one of the great places, if you love film music, to just walk into that space. It makes you joyful knowing what has been recorded in that room. Plus,
you can feel the energy.
This is a secret I'd like to share with our score listeners. There's a couch upstairs that if you've flown overnight from LA and you have to make a 10 o'clock session at Abbey Road 1, and at 10 the downbeat starts and everybody seems to be fairly organized and it's going great, and Isabel Griffiths, the great contractor, has everything under control, you can sneak upstairs to that couch and just say you're going to close your eyes for a minute because you've been on a plane all night. And then about 1 o'clock, someone gently shakes you and says, lunch. So it's a well-known secret that's a Los Angeles to London tradition.
That's that area, by the way, gives me nightmares because I think I've shared this before, but if you haven't heard the story, when we were shooting Score, the documentary there, we were setting all of our stuff up and we had the conversion plugs and everything for our lighting. And right before Mission Impossible was going to start recording, we blew the circuit in Studio One. And we had about six engineers up there. They came up faster than an ambulance. Oh, what's going on? This is the sector that the power went out. And we're like, oh, no. And so from then on, that was like our, it was like, never plug anything in any of these places until you check with somebody.
Wow. Good to know.
That couch, I had the opposite effect. I needed to be resuscitated on that couch after after that incident.
I actually arrived, and then we'll get back to our score of the podcast, but I arrived once for some scoring date at Abbey Road, and they got started, and, you know, you fly overnight, you'd land at Heathrow at like 6:30 in the morning, have a coffee, get in a cab, go right to Abbey Road, and they'd be ready to go at 10. You could do it. And you always thought ambitiously, I can handle this. I'll go through the first day and then I'll go to sleep at night. Well, that couch was there. And once I went upstairs to that couch after it had gotten started just to see, and they had put yellow tape, like a police line over it. And it said on above it, hold for Robert Kraft. They knew my secret sneaking out there. Did you know that Score listeners, that our podcast listeners can save 25% off their first purchase of any Spitfire audio product? You just have to be able to tell one of these Abbey Road stories and use the promo code SCORE2021. That's all one word, SCORE2021. You get for that use of the promo code 25% off.
That's huge. Yeah, and then once again, listen for that demo at the end of the show today and use the promo code if you want to purchase any of those packages. As a first-time purchaser of Spitfire products, save 25% from us to you. We're so glad to bring that to you. Robert, we have something to bring back. We didn't do it last week, but that's the wrong button. Where's my noise?
That's what we're going to bring back?
There it is. There it is, the return of the mailbox. It is breaking news, though. It is breaking news.
Thank you.
We have a message here from Aaron Daniel Jacob, and he has a question about representation. Hi, Kenny and Robert, longtime fan, first-time emailer. How imperative is it for a media composer to have an agent or manager to help them find jobs? I'm just breaking into making some money, writing music for TV. I have no agent, and all my jobs come from connections I've made from former clients who want to use me again or recommend me to someone else. This seems to be the norm for a lot of folks, but I've heard of an equal amount of composers who rely heavily on their representation for their next gig. So what are the benefits and disadvantages of having or not having representation?
It's a fabulous question, Aaron Daniel Jacob. You have three first names, so I guess you can move them around all the time. But I'll call you ADJ for now. And I'm gonna tell you that you have asked a wonderful question, and one that is the great riddle of anyone in the entertainment business as a performer, creator, writer, actor, musician, which is, how do I get work without an agent? How do I get an agent without work? So I'm going to tell you that you've answered the question in your question. You say, I get most of my work, and thank you and congratulations for doing this all on your own, through word of mouth. Here's my question for you, because you've asked the question yourself. What happens if I am producing something and I'm watching my small screen at home and I hear something I really like and I look it up and it's Aaron Daniel Jacob composed the music? I don't know you. I don't have anybody to ask word of mouth. I want to find you. What do I do? Well, the first thing I would do as a producer in Hollywood or in New York or in London is I'd go to IMDb and I'd go to your page and I'd look for your contact info, and I would hope, for my sake, not for yours, but for mine, that you're represented by someone I know and deal with. Because then there's a shorthand I can have, which is I can call up one of the agents or agencies and say, it says here you represent this person. What do they like to charge? What can you tell me more about them? Would they be available? Would they be interested? This would be in place of me calling you directly, which would be uncomfortable as your career expands, because The last thing I want to do is negotiate with you. In other words, what would it be like if I wanted Alexander Desplat to score my next movie? Do you think I would call, and God bless you, Aaron, that you become the next Alexander Desplat? But you can see where I'm going here, which is, as your career expands, having an agent is going to be extremely necessary. Because, number one, it gives you complete cred. If your agent is one of the agents that producers deal with or studios deal with, you're instantly in a new club, which is, oh, yep. You're part of a crew that I understand, and I can walk the walk and talk the talk with these representatives. We know what to ask. I don't want to call you. Let's say I find your cell phone from a friend of a friend of a friend, or I track you down. Hey, man, what do you charge? Well, you have to now say, I really don't know. Depends what, you know, no agent would negotiate like that. And are you available? Well, I'm not sure. I don't want to have that conversation with you. I want to call your representative, say, here's the budget. Can he do it for this? Can he do it for that? Is he available in May? Is he available in November? Yes or no, in or out, let's go. And your agent hopefully will say, yes, he's available. Yes, he's affordable.
Isn't it possible too, if, let's say, using the Alexander Desplat example, someone calls and says, we want Desplat to score this movie. And they say, boy, that's way out of your budget. But on our roster is Aaron Daniel Jacob, who is a hot up-and-comer. He has a great sound. He can do those types of Desplat sounds that you like. Let him do up a little demo here and show you what he can do. And maybe that's the way Aaron Daniel Jacob gets his first sort of big-budget feature, is he's a little bit less expensive than Desplat.
Absolutely correct. In other words, there's kind of a major league, all yeah. the teams that are major league.
Yeah, I always like sports,
and then
is the best
everybody
way.
Everybody else. Yep.
Yeah.
If I run to find you, I'm going to go to look at the rosters of the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Padres, we could go through all 32 teams. If you're not on one of those, it's a little bit of, well, you're a really good player, I hear, but I don't know where to find you. By the way, I'll end my soliloquy about why agents are important this way. Can you tell me one major composer who doesn't have an agent? Call me when you find that answer. I can tell you that John Barry, for a minute, used his lawyer, but then came back to an agent. John Barry, rest in peace. So there is that occasional, but he's John Barry. I mean, you go see Out of Africa or James Bond and you want to reach John Barry, well, you just figure out who knows him. But
the tough question seems to be when to get the agent.
As soon as that, one
it's
says
the chicken
to you,
or the egg thing.
Yeah. As soon as
someone reaches
to you,
out to you and says, I want to be your agent, it's probably a good time to be an agent.
Correct. And they will reach out to you when you have some things happening. That Excellent. Is our score, the mailbox answer for the day. Yes.
Aaron Daniel Jacob, thanks for that question. If you have a question for the show, you can email us at scorethemailbox@epicleft.com, EPICLEFF.com. We'll try to answer your question on the show or on Twitter or Facebook if you have those ways of connecting with us as well. We can do it like that. I do want to mention, too, don't forget to subscribe to More Score if you haven't done so already. We already have a ton of our listeners who have joined, and it's a lot of fun. We have exclusive interviews that aren't on the show here at Score the Podcast. A couple weeks ago, we had Carlos Rafael Rivera from The Queen's Gambit. Most recently, we had Fernando Arroyo Lascarain, who is a studio musician here in Hollywood, and also happens to be the composer of Blockbuster, Matt's podcast. And Fernando had some great, great insight on the orchestra, the working orchestra during recording sessions on the stage. So, you know, you may know about the orchestras in general, but it's a different working beast behind closed doors in those sessions. And he opens the curtain, peels the curtain back for us, And here's a little clip I'm going to play you of him talking about playing in scoring sessions, cold reading music that gives you goosebumps, and trying to play impossible cues composers have written.
I've played some scores where, you know, we'll have a quarter note, like 100 for like this. And they want us to play 2-octave run in one beat. Impossible. It's not going to happen, you know? There's just your fingers kind of move that fast.
What do you do if something's not possible? Have you been in a session where something literally can't be done? And then what happens?
Yeah, it seems like that actually, that probably happens
we
a
make
lot,
it
especially
happen.
With composers.
But
it's
how do you...
professional faking. Well, I'll show you. So if I have a fast string scale, let's say even if it's an octave, let's say A flat major, right? Right, and I'm playing it, kind of playing all the notes. But if it's faster than that, I might go.
You just
so
get
the same effect, but it's kind of, I'm sort of skipping some notes.
Such a cool conversation. You guys got to go check it out. More Score on Patreon. It's an exclusive place for bonus episodes. We have hangouts with the crew, and there's also exclusive merchandise. There's a really sweet coffee mug on there and an exclusive t-shirt. So don't miss out if you want more Score. That's literally what it is. It's going to be year round too. So when the season ends for Score the podcast here, more Score continues on. Robert, you got some stuff I know you're working on and really excited about more Score. Go check that out on Patreon today. And do we have anything else to get to before we get to Alan Menken?
I think we need to get right into a whole new world.
Oh, this is amazing.
Had to bring that back. I think it's time then. We're going to take a break. When we come back, 8-time Oscar-winning composer Alan Menken joins the show. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's Matt Schrader here. If you like Score the podcast, you're going to want to check out More Score, our new Patreon show for Score superfans. What's Patreon? Well, it's a website and an app that lets fans crowdfund the type of extra content you want. And now, More Score has it all on video. You can listen or watch right on the Patreon app. More Score already has the life stories of people you know, like Kenny and Robert from Score the Podcast, as well as bonus features, hangouts, and yes, original interviews, like Carlos Rafael Rivera from The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Did you know he had to throw out his score and start fresh? More Score gives you insight into the film score world, and it's a beautiful addition to those of you who just can't wait for another episode of Score the Podcast. Best of all, More Score is year-round, no more off-season. Go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score.
Hello, this is Pinar Toprak. You're listening to Score the Podcast. Now let's go back to the show.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. What a huge guest for our show today. He's a legendary songwriter and composer. Check this out. 8 Oscars, 11 Grammys, 7 Golden Globes, a Tony, and most recently an Emmy in 2022, which gave him the E in EGOT, making him only the 16th person to join the exclusive club of EGOT status. Alan Menken joining the show today.
A particular treat for me, of course, because we go way back, but it's just wonderful. Alan, I think when I first met you, none of the things that Kenny just read off had occurred. So it's really amazing to hear that list. And I can actually say that really shop-worn cliche. I knew him when.
I remember your first album cover and walking on the street. God. Remember those pants?
Do you get something for EGOT status? Do you get a card? Do you get like no reservations at all restaurants? Like there's only 16 people in the world with that status. Do they give you anything for that?
I think you get like a CVS coupon of some kind, you know.
They're long, those long receipts.
Yeah, you get your agent, Richard Kraft, stopping complaining about it. So that's a big plus.
Wow, that's huge.
Because for years he was saying, one more and you got the EGOT. I said, I'm fine. He said, oh, one more and you got the EGOT. I said, okay, but you should have the EGOT. So I have to, but he said it enough. I began to go, okay, I should have the EGOT.
If I'm not mistaken, was it the Daytime Emmy adding the E? Was that the
Yes. And the Coup de Grâce was the Daytime Emmy. We had actually, Howard Ashman and I had actually gotten an honorary Emmy all the way back, actually, I think maybe before any of the other awards, for a song that Roy Disney asked us to write, which was an anti-drug song called A Million Wild and Wonderful Ways to Say No, which, given my background, was a little ironic, but so it's always an honorary one. But
now you got the real deal.
I actually remember Roy Disney coming into the record plant when we were working on Little Mermaid, staring at a computer synthesizer. It was like the DX7 without the keyboards. It was just a lot of blinking lights. And he looked at it and he said, for some reason, do you have a tuba in that thing? I don't know why Roy Disney would be concerned, but Alan, it was so great. I mean, I know we wanted to talk about all your films, but I said to Kenny and Carol before we started that I just wanted to mention to Alan the most surprising fact of everything he's written. I was incredibly moved by, for personal reasons, Newsies, which I know that everyone must acclaim all the other things, but I heard the song King of New York. I went with my mother to see the film, and I thought, it's one of the three songs in the world that I wish I'd written. It just nailed it. And I thought,
thank you.
And Santa Fe, I always loved that score. And I know everyone talks about all your other work, but Newsies went unheralded. Of course, it came back as a Broadway hit.
I won my Tony for it. I know.
You won your Tony for it. But the film, for whatever reason,
I got my Razzie Award for Newsies.
The film?
Yeah, worst song of the year. I found out the night I won the two Oscars for Beauty, I was back in the press room, and they said, how does it feel to win the song for worst song of the year? And I thought it was a joke. I said, bad joke. He said, no, you won the Razzie Award for worst song, and that was for the song High Times, Hard Times. High Times, Hard. Great. You know, remember Anne Margaret on the Swing.
So let me reintroduce you then. The REGOT winner, Alan Menken, joining the show.
REGOT, a Razzie.
And let's go back because, you know, a lot of us know your story, but we kind of want to dive in a little bit. So you were born in Manhattan, is that correct?
Correct.
So you were just surrounded by Broadway. Were you in a musical family? Was your family involved in musicals or plays, or what drew you to that?
No. They weren't professionally involved. They were passionately involved as fans. My father and all the men in my family, as I've said many times, were dentists, every single one of them. My grandfather was a dentist, my father's father. My father was a dentist. My father's brother was a orthodontist. My mother's sister's husband was a dentist. My father's sister's husband was a dentist. It was just like went on and on. Dentist. But my dad would love to sit at the piano and play. And my mother was an actress and writer, and a dentist's wife in New Rochelle. And that primarily what she did was, you know, be a great mom. But she would work, and they were very involved with, you know, entertainment business, I guess, in terms of being fans. And I was just, I was one of those kids who was born just wanting to make music. It was just clearly in my blood. And I remember and from the earliest time, just being attached to music. And then I remember, I said, you know, when Fantasia came out, and there was these great images with this great classical music. Then images and music became married in my brain, I think. And I really was not good at anything else. I was so ADD. I was a horrible student. Like, that, how am I going to be a dentist? I mean, I have to be a dentist. I think, how do I do this? And then, thank God I found a way to not be a dentist.
Did you jump into piano lessons at an early age? Were your parents okay with that? Or were they saying, why aren't you learning what a cavity is?
Oh, more than okay. Well, yes, they were, in fact, saying, Alan is practicing for an hour, but he's not learning the piece. The teacher would say, Alan's not learning the pieces, but he's playing it for an hour. And I had to admit, I was learning the beginning of a Beethoven sonata, and then I would make up my own because I got bored. And I also didn't like having to read somebody else's notes, apparently.
Oh, I love hearing that. Did you write? I mean, in other words, was writing and thinking of your own songs an early instinct?
It was, but I didn't know what it was. I thought I was doing was just faking it. You know, that was good enough. At that age, it was good enough for me. I'm just like, okay, you know, no, it's easy. I'm just, sorry. So, someone tried to FaceTime me. I don't know how to turn on Do Not Disturb on this. I'm sorry, guys.
This is the world we live in, Alan. I think everyone's gone through this.
Yep.
Okay, that was Glenn. That was the great Glenn Slater calling me, my lyricist, because we have a meeting on a project, and supposedly he was supposed to deliver a new lyric this morning, but it never came.
Uh-oh.
So we were talking about, I guess, how I developed, you know, that Fantasia and the visuals. And
you said you thought when you were writing songs at the beginning, you weren't really aware you were writing songs. You said you were kind of like faking.
Yeah. No kid thinks that actually making music is a viable way to make a living. If your father was a lawyer or a doctor or a, you know, teacher or whatever, you go, I'm going to make music. And they go, yeah, great, right. And I still pinch myself that, you know, it worked.
At what point did you start to take it like really serious though? I mean, everyone, I think I played viola in elementary school and then it kind of phased out. But at what point do you take the next step and you think like, wow, I'm really good at this, or I should pursue this as something?
Well, to be honest, when every other option was either too unappealing or not doable, I went to college as a pre-med.
Wow.
And did not last more than, you know, a couple of classes because I just was not, you know, the people who were really driven were driven, and I was not. Plus, it was those years. I started college in 1967. They were pretty much, those were the years when we were all counterculture, or many of us were, and I was very counterculture. I grew up as a kid with a peptic ulcer. I was very tense. So, you know, the 60s, late 60s, were kind of a boon to my nervous system. It was like, hey, let's party. But after college, it's like, okay, I got to make a living now. Whoops. The first thing I did was like, well, I had my old classical repertoire and I'm good at faking music. So I began to play for ballet and dance classes all over the city. I wrote a rock ballet and I met a ballet dancer named Janice Roswick, who I've now been married to for nearly 50 years. I joined
Bravo. I
a
think
workshop.
That deserves some applause.
Thank you.
That's so great. Was she in the rock ballet by any chance?
Yes.
Oh,
she
nice.
Walked into the room and I was like, oh my God, this is, it was like totally, I must know this girl. I joined this BMI Musical Theater Workshop.
And, Lehman Engel?
With Lehman Engel. And remember, the first day I walk in, there's also, my, you know, someone who became a dear friend of mine, Maury Esten, was there. He was a graduate student at Yale at the time. And of course, Maury then, you know, became, he's the writer of Nine and Titanic. And
the stage musical Titanic, and many other wonderful musicals. But I did, from that point on, I just said, I'm, no matter what happens, this is what I'm going to do with my life. I was writing jingles, and I became a part of that scene. I was playing in clubs at the ballroom, and you know, you remember the clubs, ballroom, Tramps, Reno Sweeney, Snafu. I wasn't quite at CBGB level, but I remember Snafu. And I was just making music, you know, in any way possible. But to appease my parents, that workshop was vital to me. And somehow the marriage of the, you know, the classical music I grew up with and the pop music that we all, you know, inculcated ourselves with, and the structure of musical theater, and my general nature as a chameleon, kind of where I'm able to take on musical style and just kind of have fun with it and make it my own. That led to me finding a voice in musical theater that became huge for me.
I think you just answered a question, which is, you know, was pop or rock or being a kind of solo artist or a recording artist a lane that was interesting to you, or was musical theater it?
Yes, no, it was interesting. Look, when I saw your album cover, Robert, I was jealous. I wanted to record an album, but I was, Janice and I, at that point, were married. I was working on musicals. I didn't want to do the tour thing. That always felt exhausting to me. And for years I struggled with that. Well, I should make an album. And I, in fact, had a deal with Columbia Records then, you know, now Sony, to make an album. And I just kept putting it off and putting it off, putting it off, because I had other projects and I knew I had to support it with a campaign of performing. And I just didn't want to put some time aside to do that. It's so difficult. And I actually found my greatest asset in allowing my voice to come through characters and through stories and through situations, and have it not be about what is Alan Menken feeling in his heart or thinking. And also I went from being a composer lyricist to being a composer, you know, 90% of the time, a composer with other lyricists and a lot of other lyricists. And that was so liberating. To have a lyricist like Howard Ashman or Stephen Schwartz or Tim Rice or David Zippel or Glenn Slater, Jack Feldman. He's incredibly talented people.
I have the list here. I actually made Lynn Ahrens even made the list. And Pasek and Paul. I mean, you've been certainly collaborated with.
Yeah, Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Tremendous talent.
If I can recommend to our listeners to go watch the Howard documentary on Disney Plus, which really tells a great story about you and Howard. But for those that haven't seen it, can you tell us a little bit about how you and Howard Ashman, the great lyricist, came to be a dynamic duo in Hollywood?
Well, first we were a dynamic duo off Broadway.
I went to that show, by the way.
Which one? Rosewater?
I was jealous of you. See, it all comes back. Little Shop of Horrors. No, I saw that on 2nd Avenue. My manager took me. He said, you could be doing something like this. And we went to the Orpheum to see it.
And here we are. Jealous of each other. And here we are. I was exclusively a composer lyricist. And I get a call from Maury Yeston. I'll do my Maury impression. Alan, it's Maury. this is Howard Ashman. Who has the rights to do a Vonnegut novel, but he wants to write the lyrics as well. Would you be interested? I said, well, sure. You know, I'll help him out. Why not? I'll meet with him. So I met with Howard. Howard also had a theater, the WPA theater, that he was artistic director of. And that was a huge, you know, step up. And I was a big Vonnegut fan. So yes, make a long story short, Howard and I got together then and wrote God Bless You, Mr. Rosewater, which was a success to Steam. It got a good review in the New York Times, but it had one problem. It was a off-Broadway show with a cast of 14, and it just can't price it out. It would have to move to Broadway, but it didn't have that Broadway sensibility. And Howard said, okay, next show is going to be no more than 9 characters, and with some sort of a device in the middle of it that's really attention-catching. And he always had this idea of the Corman movie, The Little Shop of Horrors. And so, yes, with Little Shop of Horrors and that, you know, Muppet man-eating plant, we had our breakthrough. And when Little Shop was produced, we had a general manager, Albert Poland, who wanted to help us find our producers. In New York, those producers were the Schubert Organization. In London, it was Cameron McIntosh. And in Los Angeles, it was David Geffen. That was the same group of people who had done Cats, and they came together to produce Little Shop. Flash forward, Jeffrey Katzenberg and Michael Eisner then are coming, and they are now running Disney, and they're looking for who is a person who can help us figure out how to incorporate music into a new generation of music into our movies. And I'm sure Jeffrey spoke to David Geffen, who said, get Howard Ashman. At that time, Howard and I actually were working with different people. He was working with Marvin Hamlisch on a musical called Smile. I was working with Tom Ion, who had written Dreamgirls, on a musical called Kicks. So for me, the big headline was, oh, I'm going to get to work with Howard again. Yay. You know, our follow-up to Little Shop of Horrors. And it was, of course, Little Mermaid. And it was, yeah, I think it was probably through David Geffen that Howard brought me out to work on Mermaid. We had the experience with Little Shop of Horrors when it became a film that I remember we got a nomination for best score for Little Shop of Horrors, Golden Globes. I said, wow. And who? It's great. Yeah, but it's not you. It's a wonderful writer, Miles Goodman. Miles Goodman had written basically 8 minutes of musical sort of transition. And I wasn't eligible because everything I had written had been written for the stage. So when it came time, we did, however, get a Best Song nomination, which was, you know, for Oscar, which was great for Mean Green Mother. But when it came time to do Little Mermaid, Howard said, you have to write the score. And I said, I don't know how to write a score. He said, well, you'll figure it out. And
that's never stopped any Hollywood film composer.
I didn't know what I was doing. Chris Montan helped set me up with an orchestrator, Thomas Pazzettieri, who also understood how to use, it was this thing called the Knutson book, I remember, which was because you worked with actual clicks, not beats per minute. And all of that technique about how it would work. And so I struggled to learn how. I was working with the DHS tapes, and I remember Simpty code with that audible code that we had that was that would drive the MIDI and the on the movie together. And at some point in that process, I'm looking at, I'm doing it, I'm playing what I wrote, you know, on the page with the Knutson numbers, and I want to play it and to hear it. And at some point, it occurred to me, duh, I could just be writing directly to the video and just going beats per minute. And so that's...
Alan, there's a common thread here in this story, and it comes up so much with film composers that we talk to, and it's that you had no idea what you were doing on your first movie. Were you telling people you didn't know what you were doing?
Yes. Because it was a musical, meaning song-driven, I knew what I was doing. I just didn't know a couple of things. I didn't know the techniques of how you do it. And I didn't know if what I was writing as essentially what would be interstitial music for a stage production would be appropriate for a film. What I began doing with Little Mermaid was deliberately aping the old classic Disney scores. So if you listen to Little Mermaid, there's a lot of cues that are very, very influenced by almost like 40s or 50s style of scoring. Plus there was what we call Mickey Mousing, which is, you know, a character would move and you'd be doop, 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 and you'd write it musically. I think A, the songs, and B, the innocence of what I did is part of what completely captured people with Little Mermaid. So I tell the story when we went to the Oscars for Little Shop of Horrors, for Mean Green Mother from Outer Space. We're sitting in the middle of this enormous row at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and Levi Stubbs comes out and sings a song and brings the house down, and I go, I get excited. Oh my God. Then I start to look in my pocket for the people I want to thank, and Howard's hand just comes over and goes, you can relax, you're not getting any awards tonight. So, okay. But we went to the Oscars for Little Mermaid. There we were, right on the aisle. We won.
Yes.
I was just going to say, can you explain, so you come from the theater world, and then you go into making this film, Little Mermaid, which, by the way, totally changed the future of Disney films. You guys revolutionized what that is and the music in it. But how does your process change when you go into doing a film versus a stage play? Because obviously this has to be animated. So it's not like the normal gig of a composer where you come in at the end and write a score. You're almost writing the story with.
Well, yes. I'd like to say, now, however, when you're writing a film musical, if you're a songwriter, and when you're writing the songs, you're the king. when you're writing the score, you're the maid. You're basically cleaning up.
I was actually going to ask about your enjoyability factor on those two. In other words, you kind of articulated it there, which is after that Little Mermaid experience of writing the score and figuring it out and doing how you do it, have you found equal enjoyment? And maybe Richard Kraft would call me up and say, don't let him answer this.
No!
In scoring.
Not, yes. The answer is yes. I'll tell you why. Songwriting is you're trying to grab a gestalt in a moment and constructing something that moves story forward, that uses music and lyrics in a very specific way to tell the story.
When's it my turn? Wouldn't I love to explore that shore up above? Out of the sea, oh, wish I could be part of that world.
And you do that song by song. And it tends to be a very interactive, everybody giving their opinion and feedback and dealing with people's expectations big time. When you're writing the score, once you're in the process of writing the score, you're almost like in your own monastery. It's like you block out the world and for like, I don't know, 6 weeks or whatever it is, it's just you and that film and the director. But you're really embedding yourself in every moment of the film in a very different kind of way. And I'm, in a sense, I'm being the agent for the songwriter in being I'm being a catalyst for the songwriter to make sure that the themes emotionally and musically that are established in the songs are carried through and really drive the picture.
Perfect.
And so I love scoring. And to be very bluntly honest, in a lot of cases, that especially with the way finances of the business works, sometimes scoring the movie is the best way to actually get your to get paid.
Yeah.
It's a very important, huge job. And it's very different than being a songwriter. And to me, it's always now with Newsies, as you mentioned, I did not write the score. That was
Jack Redford. Yeah.
Who he did a great job. I loved working with him.
But going back to my question, how early on are you in the process, and are you in the room with the writers? Because not only are you writing songs for characters on screen, but you're incorporating so many characters into the songs. So you kind of have to have a feel for all of these different characters and what punchline they may add into one of your songs or something like that.
Right.
I imagine the songs change a lot over time too, right? With adding those in.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's essentially as you write the songs, you're sort of embedding threads, stylistic threads into the score. A lot of them are very specific, you know, having a calypso thread for Sebastian is a huge color to pull through the rest of the score. Having that moving theme for Ariel, that da 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 da, which is basically the flow of water, it embeds something that's memorable that you put up right at the top of the story, and it carries you through the entire picture.
But I liked hearing this, that you're setting a whole tone with some of these choices, musical choices.
Oh God, yeah, it's all about that, and and the thing about, for me at least, writing a stage or film score is you are essentially ushering people into a world, and a world that ideally is defined by the musical choices. And of course, the words as well. But, you know, if it's going to be international, those worlds, they're going to go from language to language, but the music is going to remain. And for me, I always want to find a unique world for each of the projects. So, you know, going into Little Shop with you know, Bubblegum Rock and Roll, and the Phil Spector influenced, you know, songs, you get the sense of the world you're in with Little Mermaid having Calypso and the Ariel theme and a little bit of the Brechtenweil for
I never thought of Ursula. That as water. To this moment, that's incredible. Analogy,
yeah.
That's just wonderful.
That was where when
and
I went.
Which others? I mean, Beauty and the Beast. I'm thinking, is there a beautiful or a bestial
well,
harmonic that I'm unaware of?
Well, in a way, but Beauty and the Beast really is pulling on classic European classical music. If you see the look of it, it's very, you know, old Bavaria, like going back to Snow White, Cinderella. So Beauty is again very classical Disney, and I drew on classical music. It's, you know, Belle is very much in a classical vein.
Bonjour,
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 bonjour.
There goes the baker with his tray, like always. The same old bread and rolls to sell. Every morning just the same. Since the morning that we came to this poor provincial town.
Good morning, Belle.
Morning, monsieur.
It's actually influenced by Beethoven. And by a very specific sort of, it's a wink at Beethoven's Sixth Symphony. Prologue is a wink.
The pastoral.
Da 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 da. And just my little. There goes the baker with his tray, like always. So it's just a little homage. You look at the prologue. Very much, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg fell in love with having the chansons Carnival of the Animals at the top of the movie. I in order to not have that literally put in there, I need to reflect that, and I did with the with the prologue music. You have the classic Maurice Chevalier boulevard style of Be Our Guest.
Be our guest, be our guest, put our service to the test. Tie your napkin round your neck, Sherry, and we provide the rest.
And again, Sigmund Romberg operetta with Gaston.
As a specimen, yes, I'm intimidating.
I want a guy that Gaston.
So these are, yeah, these are deliberate. I want to stay in the world and stay consistent to the world. Then when you get to Aladdin, really, our take was, it's an Arab story. It's an Arabian fairy, you know, tale. But our take was, we're doing the Hollywood take on the Arabian tale, which is very much like the Hope, Bob Hope and Bing Crosby road pictures. Very, you know, a buddy picture with a big Hollywood entertainment patina to it. So that was the a very exaggerated view of.
Oh, I come from a land, from a faraway place, where the caravan camels roam, where it's flat and immense, and the heat is intense.
But you go right on the surface to make the point, but then you're going into which is very like Fats Waller or something. But to find those colors, deciding on those colors and using those colors in a way that makes people, even though they don't know it, it's reminding them of threads.
Arabian Nights, like Arabian Days.
And it's, you know, music is a vocabulary, and you're playing with the vocabulary that people understand on a gut level. So you always try to find that kind of subtext. With Pocahontas, there wasn't really that subtext to draw on. So we really went much more literally into American Indian influences and English influences.
We have to take a quick break, but I have questions for Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, and we also want to ask you a little bit about the new Little Mermaid when we come back. Stick around, we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Matt Schrader here. If you like Score the Podcast, you're going to want to check out More Score, our new Patreon show for Score superfans. What's Patreon? Well, it's a website and an app that lets fans crowdfund the type of extra content you want. And now, More Score has it all on video. You can listen or watch right on the Patreon app. More Score already has the life stories of people you know, like Kenny and Robert from Score the Podcast, as well as bonus features, hangouts, and yes, original interviews, like Carlos Rafael Rivera from The Queen's Gambit on Netflix. Did you know he had to throw out his score and start fresh? More Score gives you insight into the film score world, and it's a beautiful addition to those of you who just can't wait for another episode of Score the Podcast. Best of all, More Score is year-round, no more off-season. Go to patreon.com/morescore or download the Patreon app and search More Score.
Hi, this is Max Richter. You're listening to Score the Podcast. And now let's go back to the show.
As old as time.
Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. We're here with Alan Menken. So, Alan, I saw a story that Angela Lansbury told about this song, the Beauty and the Beast theme, that she sang this song in one take after a bomb scare. Do you remember this day? Do you know anything about that story from your perspective?
I don't really remember. I remember something about a bomb scare, but it was, you know, I don't remember much about that. There was a bigger subtext at the time, which was, I knew, and others didn't know, that Howard was terminal with AIDS. And he was a rail. He was in the studio, so weak, but putting up a brave front. That I remember intensely. I remember, you know, have David Friedman at that point conducting the orchestra at RCA Studios in Manhattan, and we rehearsed the orchestra. When we were ready, Angela wanted to go out there and just sing it down with the orchestra, you know, for reference. And they said, "Well, just in case, why don't we run the tape?" And yeah, it was perfect from front to back. Obviously, we followed up with other versions for safety, and I think maybe there's a line here or there that we took from other versions. But yeah, it was so incredibly moving. And we did two on the same day. It was Angela Lansbury doing Beauty and the Beast, and Jerry Orbach doing Be Our Guest. And it's just an electrifying day.
The story that she told, just so I can, if people haven't heard the story, but she says that she was on her way to New York on a flight, and there was a bomb scare, and her her flight was circling, and she almost was late. And I don't know if the studio executives couldn't get a hold of her, but there was a big confusion, and she says that she nailed it in one take off of adrenaline from being freaked out by this.
Well, yes, but Angela always nails it, because Angela, in the moment, Angela Lansbury is magical. She's wonderful. The heart and the class and the everything about her, the beauty, is right there. So, but yeah, I love that story. There's another story about Angela, which was Angela turned us down for playing that role because they sent a demo to her of the song. She says, I don't think it's for me. And I said, what are you talking about? Which demo did you send? I said, well, we sent yours, of course, because we had done one with Howard, which was much more half-spoken, and one with me, which was Tale as Old as Time, very pop-oriented. And I said, oh, no, send her Howard's version. And she heard Howard's version. She went, oh, I get it. Okay, fine. And she did it.
You know, Tim Rice says never send an Alan Menken demo with him singing because it'll be better. And your voice and your performance will be Tim better than that. Anybody who's going to listen to it. And they'll be scared away by hearing your interpretation of your own song. Tim maybe that's what it was.
He's a very sweet man.
Are you involved in casting characters for identifying, helping to identify voices like that?
Yeah, I'm entitled to, and back then I was more involved than I am now. I will tend to be very involved with casting for a stage production at the first casting, because you want to set the mold for what's to follow to a degree. And certainly early on, for the animators, we were very involved, and Howard was extremely involved as much as he could be, given, you know, the health situation. And our initial mold for Mrs. Potts was met upstairs, downstairs. It was Mrs. Bridges. They wanted that Mrs. Bridges from upstairs, downstairs. And then, of course, Angela was a perfect embodiment of that.
Perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember I had done the show Kicks with, you know, and Richard White played one of our leads in that. Richard White became our Gaston. So it was really just about getting the right voice, and it was not for star casting. Particularly.
What about when they do cast a star who isn't known as a singer? In other words, there's, you know, Kenny and I talked about this, which is, of course, you get Angela Lansbury and she does it in one take. Well, she's performed every night, 8 times a week, singing in one take, in tune. She understands it.
Yeah.
There are actors who shall go unnamed who have starred in many of the films who aren't known as singers.
Well, I'll give you an example of a good example of, so Danny DeVito played Philocrates, Phil, in Hercules, and we had the song One Last Hope. And Danny came in and goes, "I'm down." And Danny's not really a singer, but I knew what I had to do was tell Danny one name, and I knew he'll get it. I said, "Danny, Jimmy Durante." just to Jimmy Durante. I'm down to one last hope, and I hope.
Whoa! There goes my ulcer.
I'm down to one last hope, and I hope it's you. No kid, you're not exactly a dream come true.
For actors who don't sing, there's also the example of Mel Gibson when he played John Smith, where he was, first of all, Mel was just giving up smoking, so he was already like, he was very game, and I liked working with him, but it was like his patience was a bit thin on that one.
Is it not an option though? Because like, for example, with Aladdin, it was Scott Wiener, is that how you say his name? He was the voice of Aladdin.
Scott Wiener.
He was the boyfriend on Full House, I think, notably, was his claim to fame. But he was brought in to do Aladdin, but he didn't sing. Was there a period where you tried to get him to sing and then he realized, like, we need to go a different route? How does that change?
Yeah, I think we tried a little bit. Also, the same thing with Jasmine. In both cases, we got, Brad Kane and Lea Salonga to do the singing. And we had the voices, same thing with Pocahontas. One person speaking, one person singing, Judy Kuhn. They were both, the working paradigm then was, okay, just get one to speak, one to sing, make sure they match, and we're fine. And it was fine.
Is that a tough conversation to have, though? Like, to tell the actor, you're not really a singer, so we're just going to bring somebody in.
I wouldn't know, because thank God I can fob that conversation off on Chris Montan or...
Oh, that's so great, Chris.
One of the directors. And Chris is great at that, by the way.
He is. He's the ultimate diplomat and ambassador. He said something earlier that I just thought, it's a fine line. When you play a song that you said, this is a little Maurice Chevalier, or it's a little Jimmy Durante, and you present it, it's very subtle sometimes, whether someone could turn to you and go, really? That's too much in a very particular zone. And yet you had a way, and you have a way of crafting it, no pun, so that it actually works in the style. But I can imagine how many times you've played songs for people. I mean, so many songs that there was a moment of, are you really going to proceed down that path? And you had to be convincing. It's just a really wonderful approach.
Sometimes the best approach is go for the bleeding obvious. Go right at it.
Yeah.
And have faith that you as a writer will have something intrinsically yours that will come with it. But don't try to reinvent the wheel when you need a moment where you're basically going to go, I want the audience to know right away, this is what the number needs to do. Last thing you want to do is don't make them work to get into the number. Make it as direct. I mean, Be Our Guest was an example of that. I gave Howard the piece of music, da 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 da, which I just played off the top of my head. I remember thinking, "Thank heaven for little girls," and
it's very French, and it's very kind of French. Even the melody, it's almost like Can Can, and there's a feeling right away.
And it's a really stupid piece of music, stupidly simple, and it's designed to be the most easy trampoline for Howard's lyrics to bounce off of. You want to establish that it's French Boulevard, and then get out of the way. I'll give you another example of, by the way, of using a person as an example to just nail it. We've said this before, and this is in the, I don't know if it's in the Howard documentary, but we're doing in Beauty and the Beast, new and a bit alarming, when Belle sings about the Beast, new and a bit alarming, and Howard, who at that point could barely speak, he was too sick to be in the studio. He was on the phone, lying in a bed, as we were working, and he said, "Somebody said Howard wants to give a note, and everyone had to be quiet in the studio. And Howard said, tell Paige on that line, alarming, tell her Streisand. New and a bit alarming.
New and a bit alarming.
And boom, right there. Being able to have those touchstone, oh yeah, I get it. So much of what I do is based on, if I don't have an I get it moment for somebody, I probably have failed. It doesn't mean every moment has to be an I get it, but you need those. You want to get someone on the ride. There's got to be an I get what this ride is.
I really love that. It's such a, it's sort of, you've opened a door in a way for someone to walk through right away. It's not a mystery as to where we're going. You're saying we're going there, but I think you're also glossing over the phenomenal talent it takes to nail that from the first beat. I mean,
it's directing.
I'd like to imagine.
Completely.
Oh yeah. Let's do it that way. But then the let's do it that way is not as easy as you're saying. Yeah,
no, I'm good at what I do. I know. I won't deny that. But
it's really amazing. You do remind me of one other thing, though, when you said, you know, Howard would come back with the lyric and you provided a trampoline for him. Was there a moment, because I actually had the experience with Howard of watching him rewrite a lyric on the couch at the record plant he was sitting while Les Poissons was being recorded. And he would say, wait, I got a better one. And each successive line was funnier than what we just recorded. It was, which one do we save? He was so fast and brilliant. Did you have the experience of giving him a melody and having him come back that, and you laughing out loud or just saying,
oh God, this is, yes. Gaston, the whole concept of Gaston just had me on the floor. Yeah. I mean, he's proud of how far he can spit, that I use antlers in all of my decorating. I mean, we now take that, for granted.
Funny.
But the idea that Howard thought, I use antlers in all of my decorating. I could just fall over. One thing about Howard, by the way, he was, especially with his comedy numbers, the essence of Howard Ashman comedy number is he's great at beating up his own characters. He basically savages them. Because with a comedy song, you want to feel smarter than the people, someone singing it, because you want to laugh at them as well as laughing with them, So the fact that you're getting a song of tribute from a room full of morons to a complete Neanderthal is very funny. And then with that Howard Ashman, I use it, every last inch of me is covered with hair. I mean, it's just hilarious. And so, yeah, I've had that experience a number of times with Howard but for me, anytime I sat in front of a Howard Ashman lyric was incredible. And I had the experience, as we know, Howard passed away before even seeing Beauty and the Beast. The only one he saw was Little Mermaid. He never saw Beauty and the Beast. He never saw Aladdin. And Howard had been gone for a long time. And I was playing a D23 show. This was maybe, I don't know, 6, 8 years ago. I can't remember. It was right after Marvin Hamlisch passed away. And for this musical Smile, Howard and Marvin had written a song called Disneyland that was in the musical Smile. It was a beautiful song. And I thought, okay, I would love to, because I normally perform the concert of my own songs, but I want to perform this song of Howard's and Marvin's at D23. But I want to be able to make it sort of my own to a degree. So let me just put the lyric sheet. I went on the internet. I downloaded the lyrics to Disneyland. I knew basically how the song went. Hmm. And I sat for the first time in maybe 20 years in front of a Howard Ashman lyric. And there was a specificity of this girl singing about her journey and going to Disneyland. And I just wept. It was incredible because of the memory of just how much of his soul and spirit came through those lyrics. It's just incredible.
I wonder if the success of lyricists, I mean, you've obviously written with some of the greatest lyricists on the planet, but I do wonder when I hear this and know how incomparable Howard Ashman's lyrics are, does a Tim Rice or a Glenn Slater or a David Zippel think, God, I hope Alan thinks this is as good as
Howard's? Maybe. Yeah. Listen, when I was working with Chad Beglin, you know, on the Aladdin Broadway show, he was, and of course, Pasek and Paul Benj and Justin came in. And again, everybody, including me, is in awe of Howard. So there's a lot of that. But oh my God, there are songs I've written with each of those lyricists that just blow me away. And they all have their own amazing essences. I'm now working on, you know, the sequel to Enchanted. I'm back working with Stephen Schwartz again. And Stephen's lyrics are just knocking me over. They're so good.
That's great.
And working with Glenn Slater on this new project with John Lasseter, an animated called Spellbound. And, you know, so I have a, you know, I love the lyricists I work with. And each relationship, you know, has different nuances to it. And I know you were going to ask me about, I think you were going to ask me about Lin, right? Lin-Manuel?
Yes. Oh, yeah. On Little Mermaid.
Yeah. Backstory.
Right.
My sister was an actress. She was a fiddler. And her daughter grew up in Manhattan, went to the Hunter School. And I would constantly hear Jenny, my niece, went to school with this little boy named Lin-Manuel Miranda. And I said, oh, he's unbelievably obsessed with Little Mermaid. And could you sign this for him? Or he has a question about this. And there was just like this test, little Lin-Manuel Miranda. And years later, I mean, Lin named his son Sebastian. Sean Bailey, I think, saw an interview and suggest, why don't we, maybe you and Lin should collaborate on some songs for the movie. I said, wow. This was after Hamilton. And I had met Lin. I mean, I had gone, as soon as In the Heights opened, I went to see Lin. He's a wonderful, incredible talent. And I loved him as a person. And so we collaborated on five new songs and had an absolutely great time. That was a challenge because our styles are so, you know, he was like, when he would try to do a Menken type of song, so to speak, he was like, no, going, oh, this is, even in some interviews talked about how intimidated he was about following in Howard's footsteps. And then when we did a Lin-Manuel Miranda kind of song, I was pretty intimidated in trying to follow in those footsteps. But, you know, we came up with some great stuff. I can't talk specifically about it very much because I'm constrained. We're in the middle of filming, but we had a great experience. It was so much fun.
The Little Mermaid cast, by the way, is stacked. It has Melissa McCarthy, Awkwafina, David Diggs, Halle Bailey, Jacob Tremblay. I mean, there's a lot of singer. You're not going to have to worry about bringing in a singer to fill these parts. But I'm curious, because it's live action, and
I don't know, people don't know how good a singer Melissa McCarthy is.
I was just going to ask you, have without revealing anything, can you talk about, obviously, if they're shooting, you've probably worked on a lot of the music by now.
We did it just before the pandemic. I mean, literally, we were recording vocals and I had to fly out because I didn't know if I'd get home from the UK. What a crazy time. Yeah.
But is she,
that was last year.
Were you, when you found out that she was going to play Ursula, did you know she was a singer? Like, had you had any connection with Melissa McCarthy before?
I just kept remembering when she did this wild sort of funny Pocahontas, Colors of the Wind on the Tonight Show, and had like confetti blowing in her hair. And when I look back, I realized she was actually lip syncing. But no, I didn't know. I had faith that we could get it. I don't fret about that stuff too much. We have a lot of insurance in the ways we work, so that I don't operate from fear or being overly cautious. I just go, let's do it. And I've been very blessed, very fortunate in terms of the results. But if need be, you help it along.
Are you on set for these films now that they're live action?
I show up, just, they don't need me on set. And
writer's here.
Well, no, they're not singing on set. They're just, first of all, they're just lip syncing anyway, because we pre-recorded everything. And to me, it's an indulgence, because, if everyone knows me, knows that I'm a compulsive multitasker. I just work on 8 projects at the same time. Because that projects always go into lulls, so I want to always have something I'm working on. So flying over, all the films are being done now almost overseas, or so many of them are. Generally I'm not there.
I'd love to ask you, before we wrap up, about working with Robin Williams. Obviously, that was such an iconic character, and I can't imagine the freelancing he must have done. He's such a character in himself, and the voices he can do and the range he has to do something like that. What was that like for you, and can you talk about just a little bit about your time working with him in the studio and taking the song that you guys wrote and bringing Robin into it and making it his own?
Sure. I had, first of all, an interesting backstory. Howard went to college. One of his best friends was a woman named Valerie Velarde. Valerie was Robin's first wife. And I remember Howard talking about that, when Robin was sort of coming up, that Robin had been married to, and then of course divorced from Valerie. So there was that little, that sort of connection existed. Howard was gone by the time we were doing Aladdin, so he never was in the room. As we were doing the movie, Robin was working on Hook. So he has come from full days in this harness. That's what he was doing at the time, the flying harness on the set, to his house he was renting. I think it was actually Barry Levinson's house. I had a little spinet piano, and we'd go to the house, me and David Friedman, and work with Robin on, learning the notes of the two songs. And Robin learned every note. Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves, Shahrazad had a... So he had every note, because that was my big concern. Can he sing the notes, and can he sing like Fats Waller? And everyone looked at me like, do we really give a damn? We don't care, Alan. Let him just be Robin Williams. I said, no, he has to sing the notes and sing. And Robin, and he came into the studio, and I got the take. Alibaba had them 40 things. Everyone said, and also took with Prince Ali, same thing. All right, Alan, are you happy now? I said, yeah, good. Great. Now we're going to let Robin play. And of course, 98% of what's actually in the movie is Robin just playing. And it was insane, amazing.
You ain't never had a friend like me. Mama. Their little hands.
Can your friends go woo?
Hey, look at here.
Your friends go abracadabra. Let it rip.
And then make the sucker disappear.
I don't know where those tracks are, but oh my God, the stuff that just flew out of this, you know, brilliant mind. And then, you know, Robin would afterwards, really nice, quiet, somewhat shy man. We never got to know each other personally all that well, but sweet as could be, and, you know, brilliant.
Do you think his character, the way he brought some of that stuff out, changed the way some things were animated on screen?
Oh God, do I think? Yeah. Say the least. I mean, Robin was
what a joy.
It's the mother load of comic brilliance. Unreal. Absolutely.
How great.
Just contrasting that to Will Smith coming in and playing that character. It's an iconic role. Probably some pressure on Will Smith to deliver, because a lot of people thought, like, yeah, how are you gonna remake this? But you were able to, I mean, if you listen to the song versions, the Robin Williams one is very like trumpet forward almost, and the Will Smith one is very drum forward, playing into his hip hop ability.
Here I go.
Alibaba, he had them. How do you work with Will Smith to sort of reinvent that, but also make the audience feel like this is the song that I still remember?
It's such an easy answer. I just got out of the way. Just get out of the way. I'm an architect.
Genius.
Go live in the house. Make the house your own. It was two influences. It was Robin influence, and then there's also Guy Ritchie influence. Guy Ritchie directing a musical was already like a crazy concept, and Guy obviously wanted something very pop oriented throughout the entire movie, everything much more, you know, contemporary. So, you know, this is the third time around for Aladdin. And for the most part, I'm just like, you know, other than the writing the new songs with Benj and Justin, I really just kind of, my job was just get more or less get out of the way. I was going to write the score, but the score was still going to be adaptation of themes and needed to provide what the director wanted tonally. You know, and I just stepped back. That was true with Beauty and the Beast with Bill Condon, and it's true with Little Mermaid with Rob Marshall. It's the stupidest thing I could do is try to jump in there and have a huge influence, because I've already had the animated. We already had the Broadway show. Please, God, do what you want.
I think you've earned the position of, yeah.
Make it fresh. Make it less.
God bless. Yeah.
Yeah. Last thing I want is every version of Aladdin to have ba-da-da, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, I can show. No, I want every different one to have its own arrangement and to be fresh and new. And last thing I want is for it to feel like you took one and then moved it there and then moved it there. And I can, to an extent, reinvent it maybe, but I'm so much better off allowing others to bring their influences to bear on it. That's why I like the mindset of a composer who does what I do. And what those of us who work in musical theater or musicals in general, that we're architects. We design a house that others live in. And nice. And design it really well. Put all the work into designing it. I want the rooms in the right place. I want that. I need, you know, the stairway has got to come to the right opening. It's all got to work. And then people, you know, maybe there'll be 100 owners of that house or for that blueprint, and everyone's going to do their own thing with it. And that's great.
It's a wonderful analogy. It's beautiful, because some people might want to hang paintings in the foyer and some might want to put carpet up the stairs.
Yeah.
And yet the bones of the house are there.
Yeah. And
I love that.
You don't want to control it, but there's, you know, there are lines like with Little Shop of Horrors. We had in LA a transgender Audrey. Who was wonderful. And you know, sometimes it comes back to the estate, the Ashburn estate, and they feel a responsibility to try to, you know, protect Howard's legacy. For the most part, I just, my philosophy about all this is just have fun with the material. It's not going to, nothing's going to hurt me in what you do. But it's in that first iteration where I'm going to have the strong, you know, there I want to have the control. And then step
is there back. An Alan Menken album ahead of us? And you might forgive me if this has been made already of you singing your greatest hits.
There is not an album.
Why not? And I'd like to own that.
I want to make it. And I've been talking about making it. It keeps getting very complicated. Because as opposed to making it, you know, 30 years ago, whatever, when Columbia wanted to make it, in terms of my material, first of all, this budget, unless it's going to be just Alan Menken at the piano playing his songs.
I'll go for that.
It's a lot of work.
yeah.
My voice is not, I had a great voice. I had a voice that would just go, you know, into the stratosphere. I blew that voice out a long time ago. Probably, you know, just the Hercules demos alone probably shredded my vocal cords. But yes, the short answer is I would love to make that album. I probably will make that album at some point. And I'll enjoy doing it. I do my concerts, as you know, our friend Richard Kraft.
I've heard you play. And so... I think your voice sounds great. I heard something recently that you recorded for friend of ours' birthday. And I thought you sounded great. I thought he should be making records. But okay, we'll do that on our next episode. We'll do, Alan, how was it recording 12 songs back to back?
Okay. All right. Thank you, Robert. It's great talking to you. Kenny, great talking to you, too.
Likewise, and hopefully you can get Lin Miranda his EGOT. Is that the goal?
Lin-Manuel?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think he needs an Oscar.
I'm sure it's a shoo-in for him. You know, the EGOT is, I think it's a bit over. it's a nice thing. Okay, it's like a, I mean, like a lot of baseball players, I'm sort of hit for the cycle, but not all of them are in the Hall of Fame. So,
I think today we established a new benchmark. Though.
The EGOT.
We have to find out. I think of the 16 EGOTs, are you the only EGOT?
I got it. Okay. So by the way, there's a physical Razzie, and I found out about it years and years later. Just like last year, I think, or a year before. And Rick from my office got in touch with him. I'll show this to you. I will show it to you. Hold on. And it arrived. And
ladies and gentlemen, we are now watching Alan go to his trophy cabinet full of Oscars and Emmys and Tonys. He's returning to the camera with
a
Razzie. Drum roll.
That's what a Razzie looks like.
And as soon as it arrived, all these different things fell off the Razzie because it's so cheap.
Well, that's, I think, intentional. They make it cheap.
You know, it took 4 seasons of the show, but this is our first Razzie, Alan.
Worst original song.
We're so honored to have a Razzie winner.
This is the first time I've shown it on camera, and I'm getting tearful just.
I'm moved myself and deeply honored that we had opportunity. Ladies and gentlemen, come to Score the Podcast, home of Razzie winners. This is great news. There you go.
Alan, thank you so much for coming on the show, working through the technology, of course. There's obviously no sign of slowing down. Alan has a ton of stuff coming up. Little Mermaid, and you said Enchanted sequel coming up?
Disenchanted, Spellbound, a stage musical of Hercules, which we did in Central Park, which is we're going to bring to stage opposite to Broadway, and stage musical of Night at the Museum, and a a prequel to Beauty and the Beast, the backstory of Gaston and LeFou, that's going to be on Disney Plus, and
wow,
a lot of stuff.
Well, we should probably let you get to work. and again, we want to thank our sponsor, Spitfire Audio. Be sure to listen after the show today. We're going to play you a little demo cue of some of the different packages they offer. You can follow us. There's a number of ways: Twitter at Score the Podcast, Instagram at Score Movie, and Facebook Score a Film Music Documentary. And don't forget to subscribe on Patreon to more Score. Tons more stuff year round. We're going to be doing that launching, of course, this season. So really excited about that. Thanks again, Alan Menken, for joining the show. We really appreciate it. And best of luck to all of the big projects you have coming up.
Thanks, Alan. Love to you.
My pleasure.
Cheers.
My pleasure.
Hey, Score listeners, we are so grateful for the support of Spitfire Audio, our presentation partners. They collaborate with people like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music. You're about to hear a musical demo of what that sounds like. But first, as an exclusive to Score listeners, Spitfire Audio is offering 25% off your first order of Spitfire products. All you have to do is use the promo code SCORE2021 at checkout. Again, it's exclusive to you, our Score the Podcast listeners. Just go to spitfireaudio.com and enter promo code SCORE2021 so they know we sent you. Now, check out this demo cue from Spitfire's latest Abbey Road 1 release, Wondrous Flutes. Again, right now you can save 25% off your first order of Spitfire products using the promo code SCORE2021. There are tons of different packages.